any citizen to seek ultimate redress in the one, the only forum designed for that purpose, where each of us is on the level playing field with any other. Our courts, the ultimate equalizer in our system of government. Mr. Chairman, I also would say that anyone who has made it their goal to hide the truth, obstruct this process today, or use it for political gain should summon up whatever tattered remains of honor they have left, stand up, and walk out of this room, taking with them such erroneous arguments as that the need to include graphic detail in the story referral was based on whim rather than the need to rebut the President's sorry attempt to deny reality and common sense alike. Mr. Chairman, imagine if all the journalists, lawyers, and staff who fill this room today disappeared. Imagine if they were replaced with the faces of all the great American heroes who have come before us, the patriots who pledged their lives, fortunes, and sacred honor to create our republic, the men who gathered in Philadelphia 211 years ago to solidify that with a constitution.
The gentleman's time has expired.
Would ask 15 additional seconds.
15 seconds.
The men who gathered in Philadelphia 211 years ago to solidify with a constitution, the young soldiers who bled to death on foreign shores to protect it, the prosecutors who put their lives on the line to enforce its laws, every teacher who has led her class in reciting the Pledge of Allegiance. Could anyone look into the faces of those people and tell them it really doesn't matter that the President abused his power, lied to the American people, perjured himself, and subverted the rule of law? Anyone who can answer yes to that question does not have the right to sit here today.
Gentleman's time has again expired. The distinguished gentleman from Florida, Mr. Wexler.
Mr. Chairman, many of our colleagues have referred to our role here today as the most important work a member of Congress can perform. I sincerely hope not. This may be the most attention that this committee will ever receive. This may be the biggest news story in which we will ever play a part. But God help the nation if this is the most important work we will ever do in Congress. Our work today is not about providing health insurance for more Americans. It is not about peace in the Middle East or ending genocide in Kosovo. It is not about saving Social Security, reducing class sizes for our children, or improving the quality of life for even one single American. I am not proud of what we are doing here today, and I would like to tell you why. I am not proud of the personal conduct of the President that has cheapened our national discourse, confused our children, disillusioned our idealists, and empowered our cynics. While I'm very proud of this President's accomplishments, I'm not proud of his moral lapses in judgment. I am not proud of this prosecutor, Ken Starr, who has turned government in upon itself, distorted our system of justice in a politically inspired witch hunt that rivals McCarthyism in its sinister purpose, that asks mothers to betray daughters, Secret Service officers to betray their highest charge, and lawyers to betray their clients, dead or alive, all in search of a crime to justify 5 years of work and more than $40 million of taxpayers' money. I'm not proud of the political attack culture in Washington that stops at nothing to destroy the lives of public servants and spawns the likes of Linda Tripp, whose concept of friendship I would not wish on my worst enemy. Nor am I proud of those in the media who have fueled this indecent explosion and left objective journalism in its wake. Now, I'd like to tell you what I am proud of. I'm proud of this document, the Constitution of the United States of America. I am proud of the founding fathers who authored it and envisioned a standard for removing a president high enough to prevent it from ever being used for political purposes to overturn the will of the people. In the words of Alexander Hamilton, George Mason, and James Madison, a president shall be impeached for treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. Make no mistake about it. Or other high crimes and misdemeanors means only those offenses that have the gravity and impact of treason and bribery. I am proud of the millions of Americans who have sifted through mounds of disturbing material to reach the common sense conclusion that this behavior does not rise to the level of an impeachable offense, and who have asked us in a loud and clear voice to move on to the nation's real business. I'm also proud of the basic decency of the American people, who intuitively understand that morality is a complex equation, that good people sometimes do bad things, that moral people sometimes commit immoral acts. None of us should be defined only by our mistakes. Finally, impeachment is not about adultery. It is rooted in a constitutional standard that has met the test of time. It is about subversion of government. The president had an affair. He lied about it. He didn't want anyone to know about it. Does anyone reasonably believe that this amounts to subversion of government? Does anyone reasonably believe that this is what the founding fathers were talking about? For more than 200 years since that convention in Philadelphia, Congress has never removed the president from office. Is this where we want to set the bar for future presidents? I plead with this committee to end this nonsense. We have real work to do for the people who sent us. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your indulgence.
Thank the gentleman. I think I'm supposed to admonish you against spontaneous demonstrations, but we will waive that perquisite of the chair. The distinguished gentleman from Tennessee, Mr. Jenkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I recently visited Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. I went to see again the battlefield there and the cemetery, and to stand near the spot where President Lincoln delivered the Gettysburg Address. That place, in my mind, brings thoughts of hardship and sacrifice and courage and suffering and death on both sides of that great conflict. Our nation survived that ordeal that divided us, and in time we grew strong as a result of it. Today, this committee begins an undertaking with the potential to again divide our nation. We should resolve at the beginning, and as long as it lasts, that our thoughts must be about our nation and its well-being. If what we ultimately discover justifies it, the Congress should have no hesitation to say shame upon anybody who would defile our nation, proceed to a judgment, and hasten to administer the constitutional punishment provided. Under our system of government, every individual is important. All are entitled to fairness, but none is more important than any other, and that includes the President of the United States. If the evidence shows offenses that require action, we should have the courage, without fear or favor, without submission to threats or intimidation, to do our duty. If none are shown, we should abandon these efforts and proceed with the serious and important business of our nation. In my mind, the task, although painful, is simple. We're bound by the Constitution and the laws. We have information, we have evidence, we have recent precedents. These are ingredients that make up all the trials that have been conducted in the courts of our land for as long as we've been a nation. The object of every trial is to learn the truth and to render justice. Our role today, and it's been said many times in this hearing, is elementary. It is much like a preliminary hearing. It is to determine if we should recommend to the House of Representatives whether an inquiry should take place. The burden required for this is far less than will be required at other stages, if any, of this proceeding. I hope to be fair. I hope to be impartial. I hope to be nonpartisan. I hope to follow the Constitution. I hope to follow the law. And I certainly will study the evidence carefully. And I'll be mindful in all these deliberations of the memories of those who suffered and died and were left at Gettysburg, and in all our nation's conflicts, because it's those soldiers who have afforded us throughout history the privilege to engage in self-government. And today, we're engaging in self-government. To them, And to every American citizen, we owe the courage to do the duty that has been thrust upon us. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I thank you, Mr. Jenkins. The distinguished gentleman from New Jersey, Mr. Rothman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Over the past several weeks, I've had a rare opportunity. It has been the opportunity to step into history and to try to learn from one of those who has set the standard for American fairness and fairness for the Judiciary Committee, the former chairman of this committee, New Jersey's Congressman Peter Rodino. Over the past several weeks, we have talked on the telephone for hours, and last Thursday, I had the great privilege of meeting him in his Newark office. And I must say, I walked out of his office with an even greater awareness of our shared commitment to our constitutional form of government and how the decisions this committee will make must be made without partisanship. After a 4-year investigation, the independent counsel, Mr. Starr, has presented the House with 11 allegations of presidential misconduct. Our goal should be to resolve these 11 charges without further delay. However, I will not give my consent to another blank check, open-ended investigation of the president. That is not the role of our committee. It is not fair to the president, it is not fair to the country, and it is not in our national interest. If Mr. Starr has more charges, let him bring them forth now. Or else we should resolve these Lewinsky charges before the end of this year. President Clinton engaged in a morally wrong relationship with Ms. Lewinsky and engaged in highly inappropriate conduct in trying to hide that relationship. He must be given an appropriate punishment that fits his offenses. But the questions for our committee and the nation are two. What is the constitutional import of the president's misconduct? And number two, what is the most appropriate punishment for the president's actions? No one wants to be partisan. Democrats, independents, and Republicans want any inquiry into these matters to proceed fairly. I hope that as we vote on the motions of today and tomorrow, and as we conduct ourselves in the future, we will remember and be guided by the words Chairman Rodino spoke in this very room some 24 years ago. Our own public trust, our own commitment to the Constitution, is being put to the test. Let us leave the Constitution unimpaired for our children, as our predecessors left it to us. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Rothman. The distinguished gentleman from Arkansas, Mr. Hutchinson.
Mr. Chairman, let me begin by reflecting back almost 25 years to a time in our history when young lawyers rose to positions of power in our nation's capital, lawyers with talent, intellect, and pedigrees from the best schools. Lawyers such as Dean, Magruder, Liddy, Colson, all of whom wielded enormous power, but none that valued or respected the rule of law. Those lawyers were influenced by President Richard Nixon. During that time, I, like many Americans, judged their actions and found them wanting. I observed the national ordeal from afar. I was studying law at the University of Arkansas. As a student, it was drilled into me that lawyers should have the highest ethical standards, that we are officers of the court, that we have a high responsibility to seek the truth, and that we should never allow a fraud to be committed upon the court. One of the brightest and most respected young law professors at that time was William Jefferson Clinton. The rule of the law was the mantra, and Watergate was a real-life case study. Now, I know many are saying this is not Watergate, and I agree. The facts are different, but are not the important questions the same? Is the rule of law less significant today than 25 years ago? Is unchecked perjury, if proven, less of a threat to our judicial system today than when Watergate was the example? In my judgment, these are not insignificant questions that our committee and the American people must answer. I'm always asked, what do people in Arkansas say? Well, as Arkansans, we'd just as soon change the subject. But we are first Americans, and we know that as a country, if we ask the right questions and if we follow the Constitution, then we'll come to the right conclusion. Today, I want to assure my colleagues and my fellow Arkansans that I do not know the conclusion of this matter. I do not have all the answers, but in my judgment, the first step is clear. We must seek out those answers. And based upon my own independent review of the evidence, it appears there exists reasonable cause to conduct a formal inquiry that is independent, that is fair, and leads to a speedy resolution. Now, let me address some of the arguments I've heard this morning. First of all, they say the president has admitted his error. Let's move on. We must remember he has not admitted anything from a legal standpoint. He has denied legal wrongdoing. The independent counsel has submitted evidence that the president committed perjury, tampered with witnesses, obstructed justice, and abused the power of his office. In responding, the president has done what every citizen is entitled to do. He has proclaimed his innocence and challenged the proof on each charge. The denial on behalf of the president does not allow this committee to accept the charges as stated, but rather formal hearings are necessary to weigh the evidence and determine whether the proceeding should end or whether impeachment is warranted. I also hear this is just about sex, let's shut it down and go home. If the premise of that statement is correct, I agree. But when the president testified before the grand jury, the federal grand jury last August, I recollect everyone was emphasizing to the president, tell the truth. They were not encouraging him to lie. They were not saying, Mr. President, it's only about sex, don't worry about it. These are not questions posed by friends in the locker room. These are questions presented before citizens vested with the responsibility to enforce the criminal laws of our land. Truth was expected by the American public. Truth was required by the law of our land, and truth was demanded by all who hold the presidency in high esteem. Did the president tell the truth? He says yes. The independent counsel says he did not, and so it is necessary that we inquire further. The cynics complain that this is a partisan struggle. Well, let me assure you that this is not about following our party, but it's about following the law and the Constitution wherever that path may lead. It's not about which party has the votes, but it is about which position is closest to the concept of justice, equity, and historical precedence. Partisan loyalties must be checked at the door of this great institution we all serve. Now we must abide by our oath of office. The Constitution gives us a standard to follow. We cannot define impeachable offenses to a greater degree than the language of the Constitution, but we all agree the issue is the public trust. Our duty is not to punish anyone, and our challenge is to avoid pettiness. But our goal should certainly be to determine whether a breach of the public trust has occurred, and if so, how do we best repair it? As the prophet Nehemiah devoted his life to rebuilding the wall around Jerusalem in times of old, let this committee commit itself to the maintenance of the wall of public trust. Thank you. I yield back, Mr. Chairman.
I thank the gentleman. The distinguished gentleman from Wisconsin, Mr. Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is my first public hearing as the newest member of this committee, Mr. Chairman, and I am honored to serve on this committee under your leadership and the leadership of Mr. Conyers. Like the other members of this committee, I recognize the seriousness of the job before us. We must seek the truth. I also recognize that the American people expect us, in fact, demand from us, that we do our job not as Democrats or Republicans, but as Americans. Because ultimately, what is at stake here is not Bill Clinton. But what is at stake is the future of the office of the presidency and its relationship with the Congress and the American people. When I first entered this hearing room only 2 weeks ago, that's how I honestly expected we would operate, simply as Americans. Of course, I recognize that we all came here either as Democrats or Republicans, but I sincerely believed that we would rise above that we would leave our partisan coats at the door and conduct these proceedings as 37 independent American jurors. I was wrong. I am convinced that every decision pertaining to the release of documents was made before any of us ever entered this room. And I believe that decision was based on the perceived impact that release would have not only on President Clinton, but also on the congressional elections only 4 weeks from now. That's wrong too. Our decision should not be based on partisan advantage. Our decisions should be based on what's right for our country. So I have been disappointed, Mr. Chairman, but I'm an optimist. I believe that we can work together that we must work together if our work is to have any credibility. Many comparisons have been made between Watergate and the issues before us. Some of those comparisons are valid, some are not. But even more instructive to our role, I believe, are the recent comments of Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter, the two national leaders most responsible for helping this country move beyond the Watergate nightmare. Jimmy Carter had a strong message. He criticized President Clinton for his actions and for not being truthful. A sober reminder that the President of the United States must provide moral leadership. Gerald Ford had an equally strong message. He stated, "The time has come to pause and consider the long-term consequences of removing this president from office based on the evidence at hand." He does not call for impeachment, but instead suggests that a public rebuke in the well of the House would be a very appropriate resolution, commensurate with the offenses of President Clinton. Gerald Ford's concern is for our country and the damage to the institution of the president, not Bill Clinton. The comments of our two former presidents provide a framework to move forward. President Clinton's conduct was wrong, and he must be held accountable. But it would hurt our country in the long run to drag this matter out endlessly. It's time, Mr. Chairman, therefore, for a focused and fair inquiry. And there must be finality to this process. For if there is one common thread tying the views of virtually every American together, it is this. The time has come to put this chapter of our history behind us and move on to the matters that affect the lives of citizens throughout our country. Let's do it, Mr. Chairman. I yield back the balance of my time.
Thank the gentleman. The gentleman from Indiana, Mr. Pease.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Today we address a subject which I suspect no member of the committee wishes were before us, whether to begin an inquiry of impeachment against the President of the United States. No matter what we may think regarding the actions of the President or the many others who have been much in the news these past months, it is not a good thing for the nation that we find ourselves in the situation we now face. The days ahead of us, no matter their outcome, will be trying for each of us, for this institution, for the President, for our people. And yet, wishing it were otherwise will not make it so. For whatever reason, we are where we are, and it is our responsibility to make the best of it. Most of my thinking over the past month has been focused on how to do so. As an undergraduate at Indiana University, I had the good fortune to study with one of the nation's great political scientists, Dr. Charles Heineman. My life was affected deeply by his course in political philosophy as we studied the great thinkers from Plato to the present. Much of our time was spent on the British and American writers, Hobbes and Locke and Burke, Jefferson and Madison, and the collective Publius of the Federalist Papers. I came to understand then, and believe even more firmly today, that the God-given freedoms which we enjoy are dependent on man-made mechanisms for their protection. In our system, those mechanisms are found in a constitution and the laws adopted pursuant to the procedure it sets forth. And despite the temptation to trivialize procedure in the legal proceedings of the land or to complain about technicalities in process, a system of laws is at the heart of protecting the freedoms we cherish. In that course with Professor Heineman, though, we did more than talk and write and theorize. I remember well his announcement one day that we would begin our field work the next Saturday, meeting at his home for breakfast and being out the entire day. He gave us no details, and I recall thinking it odd that a philosophy course would be conducting field work, but since I was a freshman, I was dutifully present. 2 hours later, a half dozen of us were scattered across the steps of the courthouse at Vivi, Indiana, the place where the local townspeople gathered on Saturday mornings to do the shopping and simply to talk about families and friends, about the ball game the night before, about the crops, about current events. And we listened. And I think I learned from that experience, and many others like it since, what the common values are that we share as a people, what the things are that are important in the lives of everyday Americans, what they expect from themselves, their neighbors, and their government. Among them are these: that they love their country, that they understand the need for heroes and hope that some of them are in the nation's leadership, that they believe that all people are entitled to be treated fairly, that their government will ensure both fairness and freedom. As I've struggled with today's questions, I return to the things affirmed for me in the hills of southern Indiana years ago and reinforced through the years since. An appreciation of the common sense and the values of the people I represent, and an understanding of the absolute necessity of a process to protect liberty. As a people, we share a heritage which provides a system for the determination of truth, where everyone who has an interest also has the opportunity to be heard. Our duty as members in the matter before us is to ensure that this heritage is sustained and enhanced here. It can only be so if we remain firm in our resolve to find the truth, no matter the political consequences. The Constitution provides our compass. I intend to follow it wherever it may take us, and I yield the balance of my time.
Thank the gentleman very much. The distinguished gentleman from Utah, Mr. Cannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I would like to begin, first of all, by expressing my appreciation to you for the thoughtful manner in which you've handled this matter, and I believe that Americans generally are recognizing the thoughtfulness of your attempts to meet the reasonable demands of the Democrats. I was pleased to see that that the Washington Post and the New York Times opined in support of your positions on even those difficult issues of scope and duration. A few days ago, I held a town hall meeting in which Lori Updike spoke of her two sons in the military. Paul is in the Navy and is stationed in Washington. He has served on a ship in the Gulf. John is an Army marksman who is currently on his way to Russia and is then going to go to Bosnia. She shed tears while she spoke of her sons, not because she isn't willing for them to risk all in the defense of freedom, as embodied in our Constitution and our American way of life. She, along with the 600 or so other people who packed the audience and gave her a standing ovation, is concerned that the sacrifices her sons may have to make may be in support of decisions that have to do more with the president's will to retain power than with our national interest. Lori Updike's distrust of the president is a small insight into the gravity of what we are doing here today. It is the conduct of the president which has caused us to convene. This conduct has been decried in the most extreme terms by members of both parties. It deserves condemnation. For instance, the President of the United States was apparently engaged with Ms. Lewinsky while he was on the phone trying to convince Sonny Callahan, the chairman of the Foreign Operations Subcommittee of the Appropriations Committee, to support his plans for Bosnia. In addition, it appears that a number of women have taken the position that they had not had sexual relations with the president, only to later acknowledge that they had. Are they lying now, trying to enter some sort of exclusive club, or were they pressured earlier? Their reluctance and apparent shame suggest the latter. What force may have been brought against them to influence their earlier decisions? Was that force derived from public office? Paula Jones had, she felt, a right to redress in the courts for sexual harassment. The president fought those claims, but in doing so, he appears to have lied. Can we allow those who disagree with our claims against them lie in court? Our debate is just beginning as to whether that conduct, which these examples demonstrate, is so reckless as to justify impeachment. And yet my colleagues on the other side are demanding ad nauseum a clear standard for what constitutes an impeachable offense. They speak of the rule of law as requiring such a standard because they apparently misunderstand the meaning of the core concept of the rule of law. It does not require clarity. The law makes clarity paramount only in some narrow circumstances. For instance, it is a defense to a criminal charge that a statute is ambiguous. The president may in the future be subject to criminal charges, and then all of his and his lawyer's parsing of words and terms may be relevant. In most other areas, the law is evolving. Just last year, the Supreme Court expanded the law of sexual harassment to include a supervisor of the same sex. In opposition to the clarity necessary in criminal matters, the rule of law is simple, that no person or position or organization is above the law. Here we are burdened to determine each according to his conscience after the facts are as clear as we can make them if the president's conduct falls short of the standard the founding fathers left intentionally vague. Here we may be partisan in the highest sense. We must argue our views. We must look for facts and characterizations that favor our side. Mr. Barrett's recollection of the party line votes differs from mine, frankly. And not that that's inappropriate, but as I recall, the Republicans acceded to virtually every, in fact, to every motion for redaction that was made in the last hearing that we had. There was a great deal of partisanship and bipartisanship in that hearing. But after the argument, we must set aside the partisan drive and vote for truth as we see it. Our duty is to assure that the president is not above the law as set out in the Constitution. We as a committee are sitting to judge, but at the same time we will also be judged. Historians with the aid of hindsight are often harsh, but our children will be our harshest critics. Our children and their children's children, they must know that we know the difference between right and wrong. If we proceed unjustly, our colleagues will reject our determinations. If we urge drastic action, our rationale must be clear. If we judge rightly, we will be honored. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I yield
back. Thank you very much, sir. The distinguished gentleman from California, Mr. Rogan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Today, the House Judiciary Committee embarks upon a significant moment contemplated by our founders over two centuries ago. In offering my limited contribution to this morning's collection of thought, I want to set forth my own standards as we proceed. First, for as long as this matter remains within our jurisdiction, I shall speak of it not as a Republican, but as an American. To use or manipulate these proceedings for any partisan advantage would be a national tragedy of manifest proportions. In times like these, each of us is obliged to check our party affiliation at the door. No member of this committee inherited their present responsibilities by swearing allegiance to any political party, to any president, or to any congressional leader. The common bond that connects us each to the other is our mutual oath of allegiance to the Constitution of the United States. We must view this oath with nothing short of reverence. Second, I enter these proceedings with no fixed conclusions as to whether the president committed potentially impeachable offenses. As a former gang murder prosecutor and trial court judge, I know the presumption of innocence is not a courtesy we grant to the president. It is his as a matter of right. He need not beg our leave to obtain it. Rather, we must passionately respect and defend it. Third, despite some suggestion to the contrary, the purpose of this hearing is not for us to sit in moral judgment over the president's personal lifestyle. If this president or any president has engaged in marital indiscretions, this appropriately is the concern of a limited universe of people. It is the concern of his spouse. It is the concern of his family. It may well be the concern of those who entrusted him with high office. But it is not the concern of the House Judiciary Committee, nor is it the concern of the Congress of the United States. It is not our right or purpose to officially contemplate such matters in the abstract. However, it is both our purpose and our legal obligation to review the president's alleged conduct within the framework of the rule of law and whether such conduct violated his obligation to faithfully execute the law. This is a very critical distinction because up until now, the heritage of American jurisprudence has been that no person is above the law. Yet despite the two centuries of tremendous sacrifice for this legacy, the ghosts of patriots past cannot compel us to maintain the standard that no person is above the law. Each generation ultimately makes that choice for itself. Theodore Roosevelt understood this when he said that no man is above the law and no man is below it, nor do we ask any man's permission when we require him to obey it. His words are important because Roosevelt made no exception to this ideal for those who happened to share his party affiliation or his political agenda. Roosevelt knew the rule of law had to apply to all men or it would apply to no man. President Kennedy echoed that sentiment shortly before his death when he said that for one man to defy a law or court order he does not like is to invite others to do the same. This leads to a breakdown of all justice. Some societies respect the rule of force. America respects the rule of law. Mr. Chairman, as we now proceed, may our committee, our Congress, and our people heed the call of our heritage to respect the rule of law and to uphold the truth no matter where it shall lead. In doing so, we will honor our constitutional duty, and we surely will fulfill our ultimate obligations, both to conscience and to country. I yield back.
I thank the gentleman, the distinguished gentleman from South Carolina, Mr. Graham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The good news is me and Mary Bono stand between lunch, and we'll try to get through this thing. As you talk about history, and history would judge what we do, people are having to execute history, and we're all tired. I'm getting hungry, and I want to get on with this. The public wants it over. The buzzing sound you may hear on your television is hopefully not me, but the spin machine is about to crank up here. Both parties on October the 5th, 1998, have come to this conclusion. They both have a resolution to investigate the conduct of the president. That is good news. Now, some of the questions we may have to ask later on to get to the truth are distasteful at best. But the truth is, I have no clue what I'm going to do yet. Now, I can tell you that, look you in the eye, and honestly mean it. I don't know if censure is appropriate, we should just drop it, or we should throw him out of office. Nobody knows yet, in my opinion, who really got an open mind about this thing. Is this Watergate or Peyton Place? I don't know. Let me tell you, if I followed the polls, I know what I would do in my district. People have no use for this president. None. Zero. Zip. 82% of the people in one part of my district want to throw him out of office. If I followed the polls, I could sit up here and rant and rave and become governor at home. I don't want to be governor that way. I want to be a good congressman who 30 years from now, not just 30 days from now, people thought did the right thing. And the right thing is to take this seriously. And why are we here? We're here because some time ago in Arkansas, some young lady was summoned up to a room where the governor of Arkansas allegedly dropped his pants and asked her to do some very disgusting things. I have no idea if that's true, but thank God I live in a country where that young lady can go to court. If it had been a member of my family who had that happen to him, a lawsuit would have been the last thing that person would have had to worry about. Now, this lady made a serious allegation. Her case was dismissed, and that shows you maybe the rule of law works even for the powerful. But why are we here today? Somewhere between the room in Arkansas and October the 5th, something happened. They called the president into a deposition because a lot of times in sexual harassment lawsuits, the conduct is behind closed doors with just the man and the woman, and it's who do you believe? That happens more times than not in sexual harassment lawsuits. So in this country, the litigant is allowed to look at the person and their activity and their behavior. And that's exactly what was going on in Paula Jones' lawsuit. Does the president have a pattern of conduct of approaching people at work for him and soliciting sex mildly or forcefully? And the judge allowed that conduct to be investigated, and the president was placed under oath in the Paula Jones case. And Ms. Lewinsky comes up. That's why we're here today. How would you like it in your lawsuit if you find out later on that he lied through his teeth about a member of your family, that the gifts that you wanted to prove an essential part of your case wound up under the secretary's bed of the guy you're suing, that if soon as he leaves the deposition, he goes back and he coaches a witness about what to say, and your government, after knowing all that, said, we're tired of it, let's quit. That is one scenario that may play itself out. The other scenario is that this guy just has a problem and he can't control himself, and it's about human failings and censure is appropriate and we don't need to turn the country upside down. Nobody can tell me yet whether this is part of a criminal enterprise or a bunch of lies that build upon themselves based on not wanting to embarrass your family. If that's what it is, about an extramarital affair with an intern, and that's it, I will not vote to impeach this president, no matter if 82% of the people home want me to, because we will destroy this country. If it is about a criminal enterprise where the operatives of the president at every turn confront witnesses against him in illegal ways, threaten people, extort them. If there's a secret police unit in this White House that goes after women or anybody else that gets in the way of this president, that is Richard Nixon times 10, and I will vote to impeach him. Thank you.
I thank the distinguished gentleman. The wedding feast at Cana, the good Lord saved the best wine to last, and we've, in addition to following the Rodino format, we're following the wedding feast at Cana by having the best at last. Ms. Bono.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, this past year has been a very difficult time for our country, and it has been a very difficult time for me personally. For the past 9 months, we have become increasingly consumed by this one issue, and it has wounded us as a people. Finally, today we have the opportunity to begin a healing process that will put this issue behind us. It is very important that the truth does not get lost in the process. This is not about Republicans, and it's not about Democrats. This is also not about sex. It is bigger than that because it is about the public trust. The abuse of trust is what fuels the cynicism of politicians. This process is about the fundamental trust that is so important to the country's conscience. People hope to point to the White House with pride. We believe that presidents told the truth and set an example through their actions. We parents want our children to respect and admire our president and our leaders. It is as simple as the old story of George Washington chopping down the cherry tree. These lessons have inspired my kids to dream about becoming the American president when they grow up, my son and my daughter. And I want my kids, I want all kids, to be able to have that dream. But the message they are hearing today makes me lose faith that they will have that goal after all of this is done. That is how damaging this has been. Our forefathers decided more than 200 years ago that we would no longer be under the rule of a king, and many paid the ultimate sacrifice in the name of that freedom. They wanted a president who would be held accountable for his behavior under the law, and that is why we have the process that brings us here today. I have avoided any prejudgment during this process, and I have focused on uncovering the truth. After all, that is what the American people hope for, the truth. We have grown all too weary of the constant media frenzy that has surrounded this process. The people are tired of lawyers who try to cover up the truth with hyper-legal hair-splitting and clever rhetoric. And so, we have grown weary of the political gamesmanship and perpetual spin because they obscure the facts. The time has come for the American people to get the facts. And it's time to get beyond the emotional reactions here. If we allow ourselves to, we can know the difference between the truth and a lie, or even the truth and a misleading statement. And I am certain that the American people will know the truth when they hear it. And I'm also certain that we are capable of handling the truth. Over the past year, I learned a very valuable lesson from the most important people in the world to me. They're my children. This year, they taught me that from the deepest adversity, there could be found a ray of hope. From that hope, we can draw our strength. So what can we do now that will make us better as a people? As a nation, it is time to find that needed strength, to endure a process that I hope will be fair. Our goal is to learn the truth. Perhaps the truth will mean that this process ends sooner rather than later, but if at the end of the day, we find it warrants further action, then we must proceed. That is why I will listen closely with an open heart and an open mind to the upcoming presentations. Many important issues were raised by Judge Starr's report, and many new important questions may also surface. There are too many questions that need to be answered. I'm at a loss to pick the right remedy to cure our national crisis, although several have been suggested. Yet I believe the committee is taking the right path with this inquiry. But honestly, I would just like to know whether the president committed perjury. I would like to know whether he committed, whether he obstructed justice. I would like to know whether he abused power. And I would like to know whether we are good enough as the House Judiciary Committee to come together on this issue. But I do know that we are good enough as a country to work to get past this. I also know that without this process, none of us will ever know the answers to these questions. And without these answers, our country cannot put this issue behind us. The time has come now for the healing process to begin. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I thank the gentlelady. The chair would like to announce that we will adjourn, or recess rather, for 45 minutes until 1:15, when we will resume promptly because we wish to finish this afternoon. I want to commend the committee. Both sides have done extremely well, informative, and if we can continue, we can finish this afternoon.